Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Ingredion Virtual Fireside Chat. At this time, all participant lines are in listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, please be advised that today's conference may be recorded. If you require any assistance during the call, please press star, then zero, and an operator will be happy to assist you. I'd now like to turn the conference over to your host today, Mr. Robert Mosco. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. This is Rob Mosco. I'm the food analyst at Credit Suisse. And I have on the call today Jim Zallie, CEO of Ingredion. I want to thank you all for participating in what is extraordinary times and disturbing times. And I have a series of questions here. Thank you for sending many of them my way. One question I just wanted to kind of set the tone here, Jim. Given the racial demonstrations and all this outpouring of grief and how it's affecting the Chicago area, you're headquartered there. Can you tell me what you're telling employees internally right now? How are you communicating to them, especially given you can't all be together? A lot of you are working virtually.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. First of all, for the opportunity to engage with you in a discussion about our business. But you're absolutely right. Right now, we're living through extraordinary times. Following on from the pandemic, we're now dealing with incredible pain in society. And so one of the things that throughout the pandemic and then through this situation that we've done as a company is lean very heavily on the work that we've done within the last two and a half years on our purpose, as an organization, as well as on our values. And we've launched a purpose 2 years ago that is really at its essence to make life better. And then one of our foundational human values is everyone belongs. And we have really leaned on that value very heavily right now during this time of societal pain. And so what we did I felt very moved to do when I saw the events in Georgia, Kentucky, as well as in Minneapolis on Friday morning of last week. I issued a statement to all U.S. employees, but it was really a message to the African-American community as well, just in relationship to reiterating our position towards racism, discrimination, and injustice, and that we stand united against that, and that we were standing very firmly with the Black community in relationship to the pain and suffering that they were enduring and going through, and that I made a request to be facilitated by my CHRO as well as the head of diversity, equity, and inclusion for our company to have our employees reach out to our African-American brothers and sisters to show the support and love that really is needed at this time to bring about healing. So we've also issued 2 days ago on our LinkedIn page as well as our Twitter page, which you can go to see what our stance is on this. And I won't read it verbatim, but it just talks about that value of everyone belongs, the position that we have taken against racism, discrimination, and injustice, and really the culture that we're trying to build at Ingredion, built around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and asking everybody really just to try to show some empathy, understanding, and compassion, and learn from one another as we endure what we're going through right now. But that's what we're doing. I had been asked to actually be part of a panel with the governor of Illinois on Monday morning of this week with a couple of other CEOs from the Chicagoland area. And that was going to be about the pandemic and the reopening of Illinois. And that got canceled late on Sunday evening by the governor, and it will be rescheduled. But that's the kind of time that we're living through right now. Things are just so fluid, but we're going to do what we need to do and can do for the Chicagoland community. I've reached out to one of our former CEOs, actually, Sam Scott, who's been very prominent in the African-American community He was our CEO before my predecessor, and really very actively civically. And he and I will be meeting and talking, and we're going to do what we can do to, again, support the Black community, not only in Chicago, but throughout the United States at Ingredion.
Got it. All right. Well, thank you for those opening comments. All right. So getting to the business, on the last earnings call, Jim, you withdrew guidance, much like a lot of other companies, because of the uncertainties related to COVID-19. But you did say that you thought that demand might return back to normal in the back half of the year, especially in QSRs and then hopefully broader food service. And there was a lot of discussion about whether that the degree to which that has to happen or it can happen. Do you think you could be like a little more specific about what you want to communicate about the pace of recovery?
Right. I mean, indicating, I think, in the earnings call and the reason for withdrawing guidance is just due to the uncertainty that we saw going forward, primarily in the second half. And, specifically what we have seen and what we're still, seeing is strong demand for food at retail, center of the store, where many of our specialty starches and other ingredients go into those packaged foods. And those obviously saw atypical accelerated growth in March and even into the first half of April. And food service at the time was still, holding up, but we knew that was obviously being shut down in various locations around the world and going through different phases where the pandemic was impacting those regions differently. What we were, I think, pretty clear on the call to say is that we really didn't know how the second half of 2020 would evolve. However, what I was trying to indicate was that we do believe within food service, you have different segments of food service. You have certainly hospitality and food that's consumed, when people travel in airports and or, in hotels and hospitality. And clearly those have been impacted very hard and likely will continue to be impacted significantly in the second half of this year and slowly but steadily begin recovery as consumers travel and that's going to, again, be different in different parts of the world. And then what I was saying was that in the restaurant trade, you have obviously fine dining, and that typically caters to an older clientele. Not necessarily, but for the most part, older folks are probably going to be more cautious in relationship to how they venture out. So fine dining is probably going to be impacted pretty hard, even through the second half. Fast casual will be impacted probably next. And then quick service restaurants, which are the most value for money for consumers during times of recession or when you have 40 million people out of work, will likely see more traffic. And especially through drive-throughs, those QSRs that have more drive-through, and I think we're seeing that now. We're seeing people that just want to go and drive to a QSR, pick up food, and eat it in their car, for example. And that's coming back, and that will continue to come back. And then as people go back to work in various phases in their commutes, that QSR business will do well. I had spoken to somebody who's heavily networked into that segment, and they were telling me that through the Great Recession in 2009 and 2010, the QSRs, because of the value meals and value consciousness of the consumers, experienced sales growth of 8 to 10%. Now, there's different dynamics at work here now, but I think the QSRs will recover faster, certainly, and that could bring back some growth. But overall, nobody knows how it's going to look like as a patchwork throughout the United States. But we think food service will slowly, steadily come back in the second half. But at what pace and in different regions, it's been impacted differently. And just a reminder, what we indicated was globally, we believe that about 20% of our volume is ultimately exposed to food service consumption.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification. Just big picture, though, like when I think about your end markets, I could have made the case maybe that total demand might stay the same. People have to eat. What you lose in food service might get picked up in retail. Are there any broad generalizations you can make about this period in time where maybe the volume is just people just naturally consume less because they're not going to restaurants and volume tends to be higher in that channel?
Right. I think that people ultimately still have to eat, and that's one of the beauties about being in the food industry and the food ingredient industry, where people will continue to eat. Now, their buying behaviors, though, are going to change and have changed through this pandemic. You know, people that are ordering through Instacart, for example, are having to perhaps not receive the brand that they normally receive of a particular type of product, and thus there's more experimentation and trial going on, which represents opportunities for various companies to get their products in the hands of consumers. That's one thing. But an important statistic to not lose sight of when it comes to volume is the volume that's being impacted also by the sudden shutdowns of restaurants just due to health concerns and obviously hospitality and travel that I talked about. But for example, for us, in the case of brewing in Mexico, for example, which is a large market for us, the Mexican government declared the Mexican brewing industry non-essential, which was very, very surprising and still is confusing to this day, April 1st. And that continued through about June 1st. And just now, the Mexican brewing industry is starting to come back. So consumers were clamoring for beer in Mexico, but couldn't get it because of some unique dislocations related, in this case, to the government. The other thing I want to just point out, though, in relationship to the premise of your question about people still have to eat, is just remember, it's not a statistic that many people know or think about, but that is food that's consumed in food service, anywhere from 25 to 33%, it's been reported, goes to waste.
Mm-hmm.
So from a volume standpoint, when food service declines significantly, the volume decline overall is disproportionate across food at retail and food service. The other point I would just make is if you go back to 2016, a reminder, that was the first time that the value of food consumed away from home had exceeded food consumed at retail. And that obviously was boding very, very well for food service just due to the convenience economy, people on the go, households, dual income households, et cetera. Now we're seeing a shift back in a very abrupt, sudden way. So the impact on food service is significant when you think about those two factors, larger overall purchase relative to food consumed at home from 16 to the early part of 2020, and then equally the wastage that exists in food service, just typically just by the nature of the way that food is consumed and that. So just to help you with how you're thinking about it.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that. If I could focus on the soft drink side of the business, you sell a lot of high fructose corn syrup to the soft drink industry. You know, maybe it's not as much as, but I would imagine that the volumes there have been negatively impacted more so than most of your end markets. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing there, and what that might mean for pricing in the future or demand planning for the future?
Yeah. From a standpoint of food service, you know, the exposure to food service on HFCS that would go, say, into fountain beverages, yeah, that is where you're seeing a decline in volumes. For us, just a reminder, HFCS for us is about 12% of our net sales. And we would logically see, you know, the impact there. But we're really focused on, you know, just managing that risk to our customers and just basically focusing on the value-added products that we provide in the manufacturing and delivery, you know, of our products. So the HFCS volume, I think that you're going to see with food service impact, that'll be mainly in quarter two, and will again slowly, steadily, like other food service, come back in the, you know, in the second half. And I think that as restaurants continue to open up again, you'll see more of that come back as well. Certainly, HFCS into retail, even full calorie, is up quite significantly in relationship to the pandemic. So that's an offset.
Okay. I think the reason that investors keep harkening back to HFCS is that there's been a long-term negative trend in the sweetener industry. It's just consumers are cutting back on sugar. But I would argue that the industry has been very rational. ADM had a very significant cutback in capacity last year. Can you give us a sense of the degree to which capacity cutbacks helped the price negotiations in 2020? Will another cutback be necessary, however, to maintain that pricing or not?
Yeah, just to remind everybody that what we had said about contracting in 2020, that it did, the pricing for core sweeteners did meet our pricing expectations for 2020. And the industry in North America, we think right now, is operating with a utilization in the low to mid 80s in relationship to capacity utilization. And, you know, I've been in this industry a long time, and I think the industry went through a very painful period 25 years ago, back in 1995, where capacities were well in excess of demand and there was a dislocation. And since then, the industry has for 25 years behaved very rationally. And I think that there's been a number of actions that you can point to, some of which we've taken, some of which our competitors have taken. And you just highlighted one example last year where there is this slow decline in high fructose corn syrup consumption of what has been around 1 to 2% per annum negative compounded annual growth rate that has taken place. And the industry has reacted very rationally to that. And I think that will continue. I just think that the industry has operated that way and that will continue. The only thing that I would point to, though, that's something that, you know, I'm hopeful is something that helps in the short term stabilize things, is that the value proposition for high fructose corn syrup is around cost in use vis-a-vis sugar. It's really, that's why it's used. And you are going to absolutely see a drive and push for more affordable formulating, even as it relates to QSRs, as we just talked about, where value for money for consumers is going to be very important. And HFCS vis-a-vis sugar, I think, is a very has a very attractive value proposition. But no question, the pressure has been on HFCS for the last decade. But the industry has always responded and reacted very rationally. We've closed two factories in 5 years that were producing high fructose corn syrup, and our sales as a percentage of HFCS from 2015. to 2019 has went down from 16% to 12%, as I indicated.
Got it. Okay. I'm going to pivot over to the sexier side of the business, the value-added side. You've invested consistently over the years in value-added capacity, in particular a plant-based meat venture that looks promising. Do you think in this environment with the United States probably heading into a recession. Is there anything that needs to be tweaked in terms of that strategy, or is it untouched by a broader economic backdrop?
We're very confident in the five growth platforms that we have for specialties growth. So specialties for us is about 30% of our total revenue, and we want to take that to 34 to 36% by 2023. And the five growth platforms, as they stand today, overlaid by the impact of COVID-19, I would characterize as following. The starch-based texturizer portfolio is the broadest and deepest in the industry across corn, tapioca, potato, and rice. And historically, those ingredients find themselves in all types of food products, and they go into all channels, and they are known for their cost-effective use. They're used at low percentages, typically with very high functionality, so great affordability. So we think that's going to continue to do very well through this the impact of the pandemic. The second growth platform is clean and simple ingredients, where more natural appealing ingredients, and those have done well through recessionary periods as well as through benign periods. And so we think that that's going to continue to do very well. Plant-based proteins is the third growth platform for us, and that is something that I think is going to continue to do very well when you think about just the trends towards health and wellness and mindful consumption, about how consumers are thinking about the effects on the environment, animal welfare, et cetera. And one of the things, obviously, unfortunately, that this pandemic has exposed is the challenges that the meat industry has, and it's shined an even brighter light on the whole meat processing situation. And plant-based products, certainly at retail, did exceptionally well during the shutdowns. And we think that through food service that it's going to continue to do well. I think you're going to see, and you right now still see, despite the investments that we're making and other people are making, that demand is outstripping supply. So we feel very good that when our capacity comes on stream later this year, that there's going to be a deficit situation on supply and that demand will exist. So that's the third platform. The fourth platform is sugar reduction. And what we're seeing is that despite the 2 months of March and April where people were pretty much cocooning in their house and maybe slipping on their diets or the way they had typically eaten more towards a health and wellness, we're seeing health and wellness coming back now even stronger. And sugar reduction, when you think about obesity and diabetes and those being two comorbidities that were very much highlighted during the pandemic, we think that that's going to just further support sugar reduction. And the acquisition we made of Pure Circle, the market leader in stevia, we think bodes very well for us there as well. So really every one of our growth platforms, honestly speaking, we think are made for the times. They're made for the pandemic times, and we'll stand the test of time from a standpoint of them being extremely on trend and enduring.
Got it. Can I ask, what data do you look at when you see that health and wellness is coming back in terms of people looking for lower sugar options?
I just think it's the number of new product introductions. It's the rate of growth relative to, say, full calorie. When we looked at just very recently internally, we looked at some data on the consumer purchases through the pandemic of carbonated soft drinks that were either full calorie or diet or low calorie. And continuously, the diet and lower calories are at retail still surpassing the full calorie. So I think that's one example of sugar reduction and just the reformulations that are taking place again for overall calorie intake as well as just sugar intake. The trends are pretty strong, towards consumers right now. I mean, there's some statistics, 81% of global consumers are checking their sugar content. you know, of food and beverages. And, you know, right now, 54, our numbers, you know, that we look at, 54% of global consumers are reducing sugar intake because it's one of the number one concerns that they have among all their dietary needs.
Got it. We've all visited your R&D facility in New Jersey, and I think you talked about this on the last call, but to what extent has the pandemic disrupted the pace of new product testing, if at all, or the degree to which your customers are coming to you with requests for proposals?
Yeah, this is one of the areas that I think represents logistically, one of the biggest challenges for food companies and thus ingredient companies like ourselves to service those customers. When you have an innovation process that's designed a certain way where people need to be typically in proximity to one another in a laboratory environment or a pilot plant environment, formulating, running taste tests, and then iterating formulations, that's obviously extremely challenging in a situation like that. What I would say is that, first, the way we're looking at it is our ingredients do go into a number of the larger established brands that have done very well for the food at retail and packaged foods growth that we've seen. We think that that is and what we've seen from that is that the big branded players are leaning on those big brands and making sure they can market those and just get product on the shelf and make sure that they're there for their consumers right now for some of those big established brands of which we're formulated into. So that's served well. We're looking at and we're reaching out to customers continuously, and each one is thinking about it differently as to how they can continue their innovation pipeline selectively and prioritize it, and then how do we work with them along with other co-suppliers, whether it be a flavor company, for example, in a fast-tracked innovation way. And there are examples of that where we're doing that both virtually, where we're having digital innovation sessions, virtual innovation sessions, you know, setting up live webcams where we can actually do some things and then ship product to customers for taste tests. It's not ideal. It's keeping the whole process and system alive. And then we're looking at how do we make sure our content for customers is very available and readily available both online and then through live chat. And so it's one of the things that I think you'll see a pullback just based on the logistical challenges on the number of new product introductions in, say, 2020 in comparison to prior years. And then I think that that will start to slowly and steadily pick up. But I'll tell you the other thing, that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And there are certain pockets of growth and pockets of opportunity that food companies have identified, and they're amazing on how nimble and agile they've been to want to get products out that consumers that are packaged differently, that are that consumers will relate to differently. And so we're seeing our products that they're familiar with, just because we provide very good tech service, that they're formulated into those products, and those products that are being very agile, formulate it and market it, we're benefiting from those. But we're trying to figure this out together, to be honest with you, with our customers. It's a challenge.
Yeah, I get it. What percent of your employees can actually come back to your R&D facility physically in New Jersey?
Yeah, so we have, throughout the pandemic, identified what we felt were the most critical projects that needed to continue. And we developed office or lab protocols with physical distancing, hygiene standards and sanitization, and just simply controlling office density. And throughout the pandemic, there's been 20-25% of our laboratory staff that have been working through the pandemic on what we would say are the most essential or critical projects that are in support of our growth platforms and or customer projects if they were actually moving ahead. We're starting next week, actually the week of June 8th, to dial all of that back up to maybe 40%, and then slowly, steadily evaluate from there. But we're going to take a very cautious, thoughtful approach to this, and the rest of the employees will work remotely, and we've divided teams, A teams, B teams, by discipline, by scientific discipline, and that's the approach that we're taking. So it's a slow, steady approach, but it's enabled us to maintain continuity, business continuity, and momentum around the big, more critical projects.
Got it. Complicated process.
Yep.
A lot of the questions I got, Jim, revolved around Latin America. Are not alone in terms of warning about the path of COVID in your markets there and how it's accelerating. Can you give us an update on what you're seeing in your end markets there in terms of, I guess, demand in the brewery industry in particular in Brazil, and then also, I guess, in the soft drink industry in Argentina?
Yeah, I'll just start off saying that we started the year, if you remember, with a pretty bullish outlook on South America, and it was the region that we saw percentage-wise to actually be up the most year on year. And never did we imagine that, South America would be enduring what it's enduring now. And unfortunately, at this very moment, it's going through, from a regional perspective, the most acute effects of the pandemic, just due to the nature that it is flu season down there now. And equally, we can question some of the government's response to the pandemic, which has unfortunately led to, in the case of Brazil, being pretty hard hit. So what we had said on the earnings call, and I can give you an update since, if we take Brazil, for example, and the brewing industry, that was very hard hit starting at the end of March through all of April. It was really hit very hard with volumes down as much as 70%. And we were very concerned about May and what May would look like. And since May has come back extremely strongly. And so that's a great sign. And we think a lot of that has to do with obviously inventory replenishment. And our factories have been running well. We are obviously managing through the challenges that COVID-19 represents in our manufacturing facilities. But again, we've been very vigilant from the very beginning on how we had changed our protocols and practices in manufacturing for frontline workers. So that's all met going through very well. It's going to be choppy is what I would say, Rob. It's probably going to be choppy going forward, but we're glad to see that the dramatic fall off that we saw in April month has really bounced back fully in May. And so far we're reasonably optimistic on June that we don't see June in any way falling back to April, for example. We're not seeing that. It may not be as strong as May, but it's doing okay. As far as South America, as far as Argentina goes, the Southern Cone, soft drink consumption typically at this time of the year, as they go into their winter season, typically would fall back a bit, and that's just seasonal. The unfortunate thing about Argentina is the default and the concerns about what that means for a very acute recession. GDP will be negative in Argentina this year, and that will impact consumer behavior. And so we're seeing probably a little bit of consumer behavior being pressured on volumes, but it's not that much more than you would expect related to the seasonality, just related to the fact that it's winter down there as it relates to soft drink consumption.
Got it. Getting back to the Brazil, actually, you said you're optimistic in June. To what extent are restaurants and bars open again in the country, or is that demand coming from grocery?
No, you know, grocery did exactly what we saw in March in the United States. At the end of March and into April, a lot of pantry stocking for food at retail in Brazil. But what I've been told is that food service establishments are opening back up again in the month of May, and that they are surprisingly slowly getting back. It's not obviously going to be something that there's going to be a rush back, like there isn't a rush back here. There's going to be a cautious step back. But the point is, it's not in total lockdown like it was in April. And we're seeing food service coming back in Brazil in May and in June. And I can't put a percentage on it right now, but it's slowly, steadily getting back.
Have you ever given a number as to what percent of your business in Brazil is geared towards brewery?
I don't believe we have. I don't think we've given that that number.
Okay. And you had some initiatives to expand your value-added offerings in Brazil last year. Can you give an update on that? Is that still feasible?
Well, I mean, specialties actually had a very good year last year in South America and equally in the first quarter of this year. So I think the trends that we see for consumption of dairy products, snack products, and gluten-free products, for example, believe it or not, we're doing very well in Brazil, and those products that are sold at retail will continue from a standpoint of the specialties that are sold there. And brewing is not necessarily a specialty. It's an adjunct for the fermentation process. So the impact there is not really impacting our specialty sales. The other sector that, of course, in South America has been impacted just because it's exposed to what we call the informal food channel is confectionery. And then the only other thing that I would say, even though we don't disclose for South America per se the percentage exposure of brewing, of our overall ingredient sales, the sales in brewing in Brazil would be 2% or less of our overall sales globally.
Okay. Got it. All right. I'm going to shift over to Asia Pacific. You know, things are changing rapidly in a lot of countries, but maybe you can give us kind of a country by country look as to what you're seeing on economies reopening and demand in that region.
Yeah, you know, in Asia Pacific, obviously China and Korea were impacted by COVID-19 earlier. That was in the first quarter. And I have to tell you, we have been pleasantly surprised at the strength of the comeback in Asia. You know, in quarter two, China has recovered or nearly recovered so far so good. You know, logic tells you that this is going to be a choppy recovery, but so far what we've seen from the first quarter in China is it's been pretty strong. Korea, the business continues to be impacted by the recessionary effects in the country, and that will likely continue. Thailand is just coming out of stay-at-home restrictions, but, you know, we have a great tapioca franchise in ASEANI and in Thailand, and we expect that to continue to do well throughout this this period. And, you know, just some things to think about when you think about our business in Asia Pacific. So our operating profit and our investment base that we have there is really impacted by two drivers. One is the domestic demand and the sales intra-region, so at a country level, as well as intra-region, and then the exports of those ingredients, primarily tapioca and specialty rice-based ingredients, to other regions. So, you know, as an example, our investments in Thailand that we've made to expand capacity are for export outside of Asia Pacific, and the benefit does show up in the other region's operating income. And so that's just an important thing to think about when you think about our Asia Pacific business.
Okay. In the past, we've gone country by country, kind of around the world. So I'm gonna ask you to keep going if you could. Can you do Western Europe for us? I mean, I would imagine you saw significant pantry loading in Western Europe on a retail basis, but maybe you can refresh my memory about what the balance was with food service and how your performance was impacted.
Yeah, so we had a very, very good first quarter, I think you'll recall, in EMEA for the first quarter, and that was despite a fall off in the latter part of March in Pakistan. And so Europe actually did very, very well. And I would say through April, Europe sales of specialty starches and specialty ingredients, and a reminder, in Europe, about 80% plus of our business is specialties. We're a very specialty-oriented portfolio for our European business. And that did very well really through April. And we saw a little bit of moderation related to the comparison to the heavy pantry loading and stock building that occurred in March and April, starting in May. But we're pretty confident that business, because it is so heavily insulated with specialties, will continue to do well. We do have, just a reminder, our EMEA business does consist of a large business in Pakistan, and Pakistan is probably somewhat like South America from a standpoint of the impact of the pandemic now. It's going through just the lifting of the lockdown that has impacted primarily the textile sector. And so we've seen a volume reduction in textiles there, which is probably going to take some time to bounce back because it relies on exports. And we see that as being slow and steady, again, going forward in the ensuing months. But overall, our European business has done well, very strong first quarter, strength through April and into May, but some moderation, I would say, in volumes, just natural, related to the pantry destocking and just consumers consuming what they have at home. But we think we're in very good position with our European franchise.
Okay. Did you give guidance for how EMEA would perform in 2Q? I think you said that you'd expect a continued headwind, but I guess that's just Pakistan. It's not Europe.
Yeah, I think what we said is that Europe would, benefit from the food that's consumed at home, just related to the stay-at-home restrictions, but that Pakistan would be down in volumes just related to food service, whatever is exposed to food service, also some of the informal economy exposure, and textiles.
Okay. Got it. Oh, and then just to clean up something on Mexico, you said that the breweries are now reopening, and there's been I think there's been some inventory reloading in Mexico. Is that the right way to think of it?
It is. Fortunately, when you have a shutdown of an industry as sizable and significant as the brewing industry, and how important brewing and beer is to the Mexican culture, and you have that declared non-essential for nearly 2 months, you're seeing a bounce back as these industries come back on stream. So they're slowly rebuilding their inventories, and we think that will continue, and the products that go for export to the United States will continue to do well. And just going back as a high-level refresher, Rob, from what we said on the earnings call, which is pretty consistent with what I would say still is the case, we said that our adjusted operating income for quarter two would, in three of the four regions, likely be down mid-teens in operating income. And the exception to that would be South America, that we just felt and knew would be impacted more given where the pandemic was going to likely have the most impact. And that's proving to be the case, just related to the flu season, but equally Brazil's gotten hit pretty hard. So that we're still kind of sticking with that. And again, just to answer your question on Mexican brewing and that opening up June 1st of the brewing industry, it's slowly rebuilding inventories. But right now, Mexico City is still in lockdown. So again, very different and localized related to how the pandemic is playing itself out in various locales.
All right. Thanks for the clarification. Okay. I think I've made it to the end of my list of questions. Is there anything else, Jim, that you want to communicate to the street about, you know, the long-term vision for the company, or, you know, the tactical changes that you're making at this time?
You know, I would just say that we have a strong focus on growth, and we are, you know, continuously executing our strategy and being directed by what we call our driving growth roadmap, which is really, I think, serving us extremely well. You know, companies talk about their purpose and performance-driven culture, but with how you opened up the call today, I would tell you that values and purpose mean a lot, and they matter a lot, and we feel very good about having those and having invested a lot in our culture and leaning on that right now. So we're doing that. The second thing is a focus on commercial excellence, which is really around a commitment to customers. And it's been fascinating, you know, to talk to customers through this experience. And we have very high standards for ourselves, and we want to delight our customers. We want to exceed their expectations. And so, for example, as it relates to this innovation challenge that all companies are going through, and we pride ourselves as being an innovative company and an innovation partner for our customers, the customers have said to us, listen, you know, we know that you want to help us in that regard, but right now, honestly, what you've done for us through this pandemic to keep product on the shelf and allow us to be there for our customers matters so much, and we can't thank you enough. So we've really recognized the business continuity and the blocking and tackling and the service piece around being easy to do business with and commercial excellence. That's been important. Third is cost smart and really looking at organizational transformation and business process simplification. So one of the things that I would say that we didn't talk about that, you know, you should be mindful of is we did last year exceed our cost smart savings target based on really a tremendous amount of effort we were putting into business process simplification. And I think that COVID-19 presents that same opportunity to further reorganize the business and streamline it and optimize it for the new normal. And we're already working on that. And so we're excited about what the opportunities are there to deliver savings and drive simplification and efficiency. And then lastly, it's really about driving our specialties growth. And those are really squarely aligned with those market trends. And I told you that we really feel very strong despite the pandemic, that they're going to hold up very well through the pandemic. So that's what I would say in summary.
Okay. I thought your points about specialty being well positioned during this time period makes a lot of sense. So, Jim, thanks a lot for joining us on in a week. And people on the call, if you have any follow up questions for me, please do, or with Tiffany Willis from IR at Ingredion. So thanks again.
Thank you very much, Rob. Appreciate it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.